The test of the artist does not lie in the will with which he goes to work, but in the excellence of the work he produces. Today we're doing part two of Thomas Aquinas's five ways to prove the existence of God. And today, the proof that we're going to be discussing is the argument from efficient causes. You haven't listened to part one yet? You probably want to, because the work that Aquinas puts into the second proof is very much connected to the first way, the argument from motion, this discussion of the first mover. And in many ways, the argument is very similar. In fact, we're going to go over the argument here in a second. But there is one key leap that Aquinas takes to get us to understanding the second way. And that's why this discussion of the five ways is so apropos to the recent episode on belief and gnosis, because this is how we can go from purely believing in something into realizing its truthiness. You begin with a simple argument, you prove it. If it holds true, you move on to the next. And if that holds true, you can move to the next. If not, you come back and reassess. And so many of these arguments have a very similar logic in the way that they present the argument, but they build upon the previous. Now, if you're a fan of philosophy, in particular Aristotle, you'll be very familiar with efficient causes. So I'm going to dive into the second way first. And I'm not going to dive into Aristotle too much because it'll be, again, another series of episodes that I don't want to get into right now. But go familiarize yourself with Aristotelian science and Aristotle's four causes. And you'll see a lot of overlap into what Aquinas is discussing in these five ways. Because, of course, Aquinas was very much influenced by Aristotle. So let's keep that in mind as we move forward. Now, if you remember the first argument, it was kind of this whole thing of movement, of motion, okay? But there was no inherent will presented with anything. That's why I purposely chose to use the word agency, and any time that I discuss any argument relating to something enacting its will in another, or causing something to move something else, or making somebody do something, whether they want to or not, I try to be very wary of the words that I use because, of course, of my own personal feelings and understanding of how will and determinism works. Now, Mike and I had a very interesting discussion about this. We've done it previously on previous appearances on the Mindscape podcast, but it came up again on this episode because he's very much a proponent of free will, whereas I'm somewhat of a proponent of neither free will nor determinism. It's kind of a thing that goes hand in hand, and you have to understand both to really get at the core of the matter. But this idea of will, and again, I'm going to use the word agency, plays a key role in defining the second way and differentiating it from the first way to prove God's existence. So let's get to that. The first part about this efficient cause argument is going back to the idea of perception, of using our five senses in order to understand and observe the world and make logical, natural assumptions based on the things that we see. Now remember, sometimes making assumptions based purely on sensical data may not be the best case. That's why we have to go through the scientific method of understanding any of these things which we should hold to be true or not. But this is all we have, so this is where we start. We perceive in the world that there is a series of efficient causes of things in the world. What does this mean? So for example, I am here. We assume that I am born, that I'm alive. I don't know any of these things, of course, because these are all myths. I wasn't there consciously at my birth. I just know from stories that are told to me by my parents, right, that I was born in this place at this particular time, and over time I gather new experiences. But of course, that's my point zero. And just like we saw in the argument from motion, we have the same in the argument from efficient causes. If I am here, and I cannot create myself, in some theoretical sense, that inherently implies that I'm not my own cause for being, that there was a previous being who conceived me into existence. So now here you already begin to see the leap in logic. Before, we're simply talking about things being set into motion around the universe, or things setting each other into motion, causing further motion. But now we're talking about existence itself. I cannot cause myself to exist, and so therefore there must be a being that caused me to exist. Those beings, of course, are my parents. And now if we take the same logical argument again and bring it back to my parents, we say, well, you know, my dad and my mom did not conceive themselves. They also had parents. And their parents had parents, and their parents had parents, and their parents had parents. And then if you want to argue this from a purely Christian mythological sense, you can go all the way back to Adam and Eve. And then in the story of Genesis, you have Adam and Eve, who of course could not conceive themselves, but were conceived in essence by God. And that gives you a very basic gist of what the argument from efficient causes is. No being, no thing, no entity, no cup, no rock, no planet, no mountain, no can of sparkling water, that's what I'm drinking right now, has sufficient cause to cause itself. Therefore, something else must create it. Because, of course, these causes cannot extend all the way down. It can't be turtles all the way down. There has to be a turtle at the bottom. And for Aquinas, that turtle is God. Very simple, right? This argument is almost identical to the first way that we discussed in the previous episode, the argument from motion. The key difference, of course, being that we are making this leap. Now we're talking about existence itself, about isness itself. And while that may not seem like the most logical thing when we look at our everyday lives and say, well, yes, but this thing caused that and whatever, and I can't just go all the way back because then it doesn't make any sense. I don't really care. It's very easy that you can take this point of view. But isn't it funny how a lot of times when we begin to look at these things in a very non-judgmental way, where we try to remove our preconceived notions of what things are and are not, and how they work and work not, do you begin to see that the most logical explanation may seem like the most nonsensical? And that's why oftentimes if you try to bring up some of the examples and put them into words with people that aren't familiar with philosophy or religion or spirituality or have had any kind of mystical experience, whether it be through psychedelics or prayer or meditation or anything else, you see that these people don't understand what it is that you're trying to talk about. And if you don't have the correct tool set to try to explain what it is that you're trying to talk about, they're simply going to believe that you're insane. Martin's lost his mind. Now, of course, that may be very well true. It's very possible that I've lost my mind. I may have lost it dozens or hundreds or thousands of times. Or maybe I just never had one at all. I don't know. But I do the work to try to find out. There is one key important differentiation between the first and second ways. And this goes back to Aristotle. And that's why I brought Aristotle up. Because in many regards, when you're trying to think of this domino effect that folks generally kind of attribute somehow to something like the five ways, we naturally assume, because we deem ourselves to be conscious, free-thinking, free-willing individuals, we naturally assume that if we try to place these kind of stipulations, this rule set on creation itself, going all the way back to some kind of entity or force or figure that created all things, that caused all things, that put all things into motion, folks like New Atheists, for example, might deem this to be totally ludicrous. Now, if you're a New Atheist, there's nothing wrong with that. You're allowed to have your own thoughts on what is and what isn't. After all, if you didn't, then my belief in the absolute existence of God would have no impact. It would make no difference. It would have no meaning. Just like your idea of there no possible way that we have a God would have no meaning either. Because the core idea of God, of some divine entity, would cease to have meaning. Because there would be no opposing meaning to discuss. All that would be is the idea of a non-entity. And so the idea of an entity would have no meaning. What do you mean there's an entity? That's ridiculous. Or, of course, the other way around. And throughout history, of course, we have, through philosophical and religious thought, a lot of back and forth going on between these two ideas. And neither will prove one or the other to be true or false, ever. Impossible. Because in order to grasp the ultimate reality of infinitude, to understand all of existence, to understand what isness really is, you'd have to have the knowledge present to understand all of it. And of course, as I mentioned in the previous episode, as finite, limited beings with limited senses, with limited computational power in our quote-unquote brains, that's impossible. And even if we were able to build some sort of machine, some sort of computer, that would be able to compute all of this information for us and give us directly the answer, we still would not know how to interpret that answer. This is why, regardless of how much science, how much experimentation, how much theory we go through as humans in any field of study, and I'm only picking on science because science, of course, strives to try to find the answers to the deepest, most fundamental questions of existence. There's always going to be more questions to be asked. And as you gain more answers, you'll be posed with further questions. Because like Gödel says, truth is much larger than proof. There are things in this world that you can prove that are true, and there are things in this world that are true that cannot be proven. Just like the hand cannot point to itself. This is why, you know, you have in the Old Testament, for example, when Moses goes to get the Ten Commandments, and he asks who this being is, the being says, well, depending on the translation, he might say, I am he who is. Not my favorite translation because it denotes a lot of characteristics on divinity that, while part of divinity, do not directly explain divinity itself. But one of the better translations, say, is I am that I am. Or maybe an even better translation would be I am. Isness. Because that's what an ultimate deity would be. It would be all of existence. And at the same time, all of non-existence. There's, of course, this argument from some folks that, we can't have something coming out of nothing. But of course, if you look at this mathematically, that's absurd. Everything comes out of nothing. In a pure mathematical system, for example, like the one that Gödel uses, the only number that exists is zero. So if you want to talk about one, then you talk about the successor of zero, S0. If you want to talk about two, you talk about the successor of zero, SS0. And so on and so on. Now, of course, there's no negative numbers in this Gödel numbering system, so, you know, you can go many ways with this, but that's just an example. Remember, never hold the map to signify the territory. It's just a symbol. We don't have the resources to understand all of existence. So we have to use these symbols. The problem with the symbols is that the symbols do not represent exactly the thing that you're trying to talk about. They're simply a placeholder. And no matter how rich a symbology you develop, you will never be able to explain in detail all of it. You get this a lot in terms of psychedelic experience, and we will be getting into psychedelics and sort of Christianity at some point in the near future. But you hear this with psychedelics and any kind of mystical experience, really. where oftentimes you can approximate a story, you can tell a story and explain what it is that happened to you. But the story that you're explaining is only maybe 50% of the things that you actually felt, what you actually experienced. Now, yes, maybe you can describe being in a particular room with certain things being, you know, maybe there's like pictures hanging on the walls, or, you know, there's crystals coming out of the ceilings, whatever it is. And you can describe those detail, the crystals in detail. You can talk about their shape and their size and their color, maybe the glow that emitted from them, maybe how they made you feel. You can do all these things, but you're not describing the feeling itself. So simply by talking about it, by describing it, you're only getting a minute part of what it is you're trying to explain. You see this all the time. This is why so many arguments pop up on social media, for example. And one of the reasons that I don't follow social media as much as I used to. Because frankly, I just don't care. It makes no difference in how I view the world. Because by simply describing your thoughts and feelings and emotions purely on a written format, or even if you were doing this, you know, in the Times Square 500 years ago, trying to explain your personal philosophy, you still wouldn't be able to arrive at the completeness of explanation. Now, some people might be better at using words. They might be authors or philosophers or poets, and so they have a much better grasp on using language and maybe can approximate that even better than others, and therefore maybe sometimes swayed others into believing their worldview to be true. But even then, those people are not describing their experience, right? Because they are not all of existence. They're not all isness. They're just a part of it. And you definitely see this when you look at one of the inspirations for this way. Again, I'll mention Aristotle, because sometimes we assume that this divine being that we're going to call God for the sake of this episode, Aquinas was after all a Catholic, so he believed in this God figure. We sometimes can assume that God is doing these things on purpose, because after all, man was created in God's image. And man likes to enact his will or her will onto others. And therefore, the same must be true of God. Because if we have it and we're created in God's image, then God must have it as well. Otherwise, we wouldn't be created in God's image. But see, there is a key difference here. Because there's no acting will that's forcing things to come into existence. Just like there's no acting will causing things to be moved. All that is isness, pure being. And pure being simply has no choice but to beget other beings. And I'm using the word being very loosely here, okay? So I'm not talking about just birds and plants and animals and humans and maybe aliens or unicorns, but also rocks and dirt and sand and crystals, mountains, planets. There's no active will being enacted. We're talking about agency here. Because at the core of this efficient argument for, you know, efficient causation is not will, but knowledge. So if we take a look at, you know, one of the classical examples for this would be a sculptor, right? And maybe nowadays we don't know any sculptors. Maybe we don't even have very many sculptors left. But it's very apropos for this discussion. So, you could possibly say that the sculptor is enacting his will on a piece of stone, therefore carving out pieces in order to make some masterpiece statue, right? Let's say the Statue of David. But that's not quite the case, because anybody could be a sculptor. Anybody can go and take a piece of rock and begin carving at it and make some kind of statue out of it. But if you don't have the knowledge and the skill set necessary in order to create something like the Statue of David, where maybe you don't have the tools and the techniques necessary to carve out marble, in this case, then you'll never be able to do so. See, this lies at one of the core ideas that I've talked about a lot recently, and one that I hint at over many, many episodes. And maybe one of the reasons why we have so much of this discussion nowadays, yes, on social media, because now everyone's connected, but just in general, why we can have so many different points of view. If we take this idea of the sculptor in terms of philosophy and religion and spirituality, you can see that you are very much the sculptor of your own life. You can very easily trot along life doing the best that you know how, the best that you can, the best that you are able to do based on the rule set that was given to you by your efficient cause, your parents or your culture, your school, whatever. And you can live a perfectly normal, valid life. Maybe you never even think about philosophical or religious topics. Nothing wrong with that. Perfectly fine. But as you begin gathering tool sets, begin expanding your knowledge, you can begin carving a much more, we'll say, meaningful masterpiece. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that a simple, unknowing, uncaring kind of matrix style life, right? Where you've never taken the pill, you never woke up from the matrix. I'm not saying that that's not a life well lived. It can be perfectly fine. Just like gathering the tool set and making the most profound, deep, spiritual, religious, philosophical connections in your mind and using those to live the best life that you can live, to create the most masterful sculpture that you can create, that is also just fine. You know, you have this Zen koan, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Because what does it mean to be enlightened? Enlightenment has nothing to do with your physical condition. And we're going to dive into this a few times over the next couple of months in relation to things that we find in scripture. Because sometimes we can get bogged down by this flowery language. We can be led to assume that the stories that are being told are about one thing, when in reality, they're about the complete opposite. See, many times, in order to understand these deep, mystical, somewhat almost mystery-style traditions, as Christianity is, we sometimes take them at face value. And we forget that they're not meant to be taken at face value. They're meant to be taken at a much deeper level. So, you know, people like Paul, for example, took this mystery ideology and wanted to present it to the every man, because Paul felt like the best way to get people into the kingdom of heaven, into the kingdom of God, was for everybody to be preached to. And so he did. He didn't just talk to Jews about the mysteries. He talked to the Corinthians and the Galatians, etc. Because he wanted everyone to know this mystery. He was so deeply, profoundly moved by it that he wanted everybody to know. But of course, sometimes through trying to make this message appeal to a very large kind of audience, you may end up losing some of the magical mystery that lives within the meaning of it. Because a lot of these stories are allegories, right? They're metaphors. They're not simply trying to give you some kind of moral guidebook to live your life. So sometimes you need to be reading these stories not in terms of the words that you see on the page, but the words that are missing. You need to learn to read the blanks between each letter in order to get the full meaning. And just like that, what Aquinas is saying, gathering that information from what Aristotle said, is that not necessarily is there a being enacting its will on everything. And you might see some contrasting language when you read some Aquinas works that you say, well, he says here that he says this, so why is... take it as a whole. And remember, oftentimes you have to kind of veil the words that you use in order to not ruffle too many feathers, because we all know the history of Christianity, Catholicism in particular, but even Protestant sects throughout the last several hundred years are oftentimes not very willing to budge from simply what's written in scripture. You get this a lot more with Islam, for example, where folks, not all Muslims, of course, but a lot of the Muslim faith is based on, if it's not in the Quran, it's not true. Or if Muhammad said it, that is the way. And if he didn't say it, then it's heresy. And so people try to recreate themselves based on Muhammad and the core ideology and put everything else aside. You see this in Islamic scripture, for example, right? So we in Western society oftentimes like to think that the older something is, the better. You know, Graham Hancock has that line, right? Everyone loves it. Things keep getting older, right? And people assume that the older things are better. Sometimes this is true, sometimes it's not. But often we do assume this. And in terms of the whole secret history of mankind, sometimes we can say, people might say, well, how is it that this building that's 10,000 years old is so much more architecturally advanced than something that is 1,000 years old? In the Middle Ages, we're living in huts, and 10,000 years ago, people were building Göbekli Tepe. How could this be? Older is better. And in Islam, you have the opposite. So for Muslims, a version of the Quran that is newer is actually more complete. Now, we can dive into the deep causes of this at some point. But isn't that interesting, the different ways that we look at this ideology? To wrap this all up, I want to finish with another Aquinas quote. The knowledge of God is the cause of things. Ah, talk about turning it around. For the knowledge of God is to all creatures what the knowledge of the artificer is to things made by his art. So that's going to wrap up part two of this six-part series on Thomas Aquinas. On the next episode, we're going to do the third way. The third way is one of my favorites. I find it really fascinating because it dives at some of the hard questions of philosophy. So we're going to talk about the argument from possibility and necessity on the next episode. But I hope you enjoyed this one. Of course, feel free to get in touch. martin@thealchemicalmind.com is the email. You can go to thealchemicalmind.com for all the links, patreon.com/thealchemicalmind if you want to support the show, and of course, never feel like you need to. And I think that's it. Twitter, @mindalchemical. I'm always available there. Feel free to send me a DM if you'd like. And we'll be back for Patreons tomorrow. There'll be a new episode. For the rest of you, we're probably done with the series by now, to be honest. But the next episode will be out in a few days for you non-patrons. So thank you again for listening. And as always, remember that you are it. All of it.